You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us here in the studio a little later on in the program at 707-895-2448, or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. We're engaged in a two-member-a-day campaign, and my show is going to be doing that today, and I'll say a little bit more about it later on in the program. My guest on today's show is writer Chris Jennings, author of Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism, which tells the story of five interrelated utopian movements following the Enlightenment, revealing their relevance to both their time and our own. This book will be released in paperback on Tuesday. Chris Jennings, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good to have you. As I mentioned in the introduction, the book explores five utopian movements, all of them in the 19th century following the European Enlightenment and the founding of the United States. And as we know, that period was really quite tumultuous and forms the backdrop for, I think, what I'd say is this kind of idealism of a utopian community. And I'd like to start by asking you to set that historical stage just a bit to remind our listeners of some of the events going on during this period in European American history. And then, since we can't really talk about all five of them in the limited time that we've got, I thought we'd start off at least by focusing in on the Shakers and the Oneida Perfectionists to begin to develop the themes that you explore in the book. Certainly, we'll probably bring in some of the others as counterpoint and showing some of the similarities and differences. But again, if you'd begin by just briefly setting the historical stage.
Sure. Well, the story really begins with the Shakers, and they come to the United States just near the end of the American Revolution. So in some ways, the story tracks very closely the history of the American Republic from its founding in 1776, and it kind of peaks, I would say, somewhere in the 1840s, the middle of the 19th century, and really what I describe as a golden age of American utopianism begins to fade with the arrival of the Civil War. So that's the general time frame we're talking about, from the Revolution to the Civil War. And an enormous amount was going on during this time that would be difficult to recapitulate quickly, but I think the sort of general tenor of the times, especially the middle of the 19th century, which is the high point of all of these movements, was a time that, tends to be thought of in one way, and I'm arguing that we ought to think of it in a slightly more complicated way. The usual telling of what's often called the Jacksonian era is this moment of expansion into the West, this boom in American industry, and sort of the development of American capitalism and the American ideal of sort of the rugged individual breaking the frontier. And the people that I am that I've written about and that we'll be talking about were valuing a very different constellation of virtues and a very different vision of what the United States ought to be. They were, for the most part, socialists, if not outright communists, full communal ownership of property. They were working towards the emancipation of women. They were often experimenting with new sexual practices and new social practices. So this time in American history that we tend to associate with these sort of ultra-American virtues of individualistic capitalism was also the time that really saw a blossoming of a sort of counter set of ideas.
So go ahead.
I would just say that in terms of you asked about general other historical events taking place in the time, one of the things that's notable about these people is that they weren't affected greatly by things that were happening in the wider country. They tended to follow their own path, and therefore it's not necessarily super relevant what was happening politically in the country at the time.
Still, it seemed to me one of the themes in the book was kind of a rejection of a lot of that was going on, that they really were intentionally trying to kind of separate themselves from that. So couldn't you see it as a bit of a reaction to it?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely, and they were. I mean, this is sort of just in terms of economics. This is American capitalism and capitalism in general is really being encountered as a fairly new phenomenon. You know, a traditional agrarian lifestyle was in decline. People were moving into cities. People were building factories. And these people were indeed very much rejecting that and were, for the most part, sort of morally outraged by it. And one of the things that's most interesting about these people to me is that many of them were deeply religious, and they felt that it was sort of patently impossible to reconcile Christianity, which was obviously the dominant faith, with capitalism. And that, of course, has ceased to be a major problem in our country. But there was this major conversation going on of, can you simultaneously be a Christian and engage in capitalism? And these people almost all agreed that, no, you could not.
Well, let's start with the Shakers then, and they're a group that started in England and with a particular person. I think that was another one of the themes that struck me, is each one of these five that you talk about really is very closely identified with a particular person, at least in its initial phase.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. All of these communities sort of tend to cluster around a sort of visionary individual. Which is not to say that once they're up and running, they were little tyrannies. They all were actually wonderfully, for the most part, despite some notable lapses, fairly democratic. But the Shakers, they begin notably in Manchester, England, which is sort of considered historically the cradle of the Industrial Revolution. So the new industrial economy was on display there, and it's not a stretch to see the Shakers partly as a reaction of that. This was an incredibly grim place to be living. People who formerly, you know, were tenant farmers were coming into Manchester to work for factory wages, and the result socially was pretty disastrous. The community starts there with this young woman, Ann Lee, who has a revelation from God that the path to a perfected society, and she read this in biblical terms as sort of the coming of the New Jerusalem, the prophesied millennium that will come at the end of human history, of peace and abundance. The way to get there is to renounce what she called carnality. In other words, everyone needs to stop having sex. And she preaches this gospel and develops a small following and leads them in 1774 to New York City, and they promptly relocate upstate, upstate New York, and establish a small community, which they eventually managed to spread over much of the country. Most of that spread, it's notable, happened long after Ann Lee died. She was sort of the visionary, but she was succeeded by a series of rather brilliant administrators who put her vision for this sort of communistic, hyper-egalitarian, sexless society into action.
I just want to clarify for listeners, you use the word communistic, and I think these days that has a very strong connection to communism, so you're using it in a slightly different sense.
It's true, yeah, small c communism. This is pre-Marx and Engels, although Marx and Engels were close observers of the Shakers and wrote at some length about them and some of these other, some of their other communistic, we should say, forebears. But no, they were not Marxian communists. But I use that word to mean that they believed that no one should own any private property. Everything should be collectively owned. So you're right. It's an important clarification to make.
And so let's delve down a little bit deeper into this idea. The Shakers are a Christian community. They started really, I guess, from kind of a Quaker background. Was her background correct? So if you could start to elucidate a little bit some of the tenets of her vision and her Christian understanding.
Sure. Well, Lee herself was not a Quaker. She was sort of an evangelical Christian. There was a boom of evangelicalism happening in England at the time, and it was sort of opposed for the most part against the Anglican establishment. The Shakers are associated with the Quakers because before Ann Lee had her vision, she was a member of a small prayer group run by two Quakers, and they had begun this practice for which there are other historical precedents of sort of ecstatic worship in which they would tremble and jump up and down, and people originally derisively described the group in Manchester as the Shaking Quakers. And as with so many other groups, the Shakers eventually took this derogatory term and took it on themselves and proudly called themselves Shakers. So Lee comes out of this evangelical boom and begins to preach this sort of ecstatic Christianity, that you can have a private union with God. And it's during a stint in prison. The Shakers were rather confrontational with their faith. They would barge into Anglican churches, denouncing the established order as anti-Christian, and the fact that they were led by a woman, of course, and that a lot of their prominent members were women was one of the reasons that they caused so much outrage. So during one of her many stints in the Manchester City Jail, Anne Lee has this vision of Christ and also of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, at which it's revealed to her that the lever by which the New Jerusalem, which was something that was being discussed in all churches at the time, there was a real boom in millenarian prophecy and thinking, but the lever by which the millennium, the heaven on earth, will be inaugurated is through this particular practice of not having sex. And she was a apparently extremely charismatic young woman who, it's worth pointing out, had grown up under extremely impoverished circumstances, had a very difficult life, and herself had a series of extremely painful miscarriages before she had her revelation concerning, ceasing all procreation. So that probably had something to do with her inspiration.
And at its height, I think you talk about it had roughly about 1,000 people who participated in it and lived in a number of different communities around the United States. So it was fairly extensive. That's a pretty significant number of people for the time.
Yeah, it was a very significant number of people for the time. And the estimates are all over the place because the numbers were not very reliable. But it's said that as many as 20,000 people eventually lived as Shakers. And to live as a Shaker was not the same as to live as a Unitarian or a Roman Catholic. It was an all-consuming faith. You sold your property, you moved from your home, you joined these communities. Husbands and wives would separate. If they had children, they would be more or less separated from their parents. It was an extremely radical change of life. So the fact that so many Americans moved into these communities over the course of the 19th century is really notable, and I think if we were having this conversation somewhere in the eastern United States in the, say, 1840, it would be unlikely that any of your listeners wouldn't be familiar with their local Shaker village. The Shakers became very well known for their products. They're now very well known, of course, for their beautiful furniture, but at the time, Shaker goods were on sale at every country store. And they were a major national presence. They were referred to constantly in the texts of the time. Abraham Lincoln corresponded at length with the Shaker leader who was coincided with his presidency. So they were a big presence in the country. They weren't some obscure cult out in the countryside.
So they did have a kind of standing in the community at the time through their commerce, even if their beliefs in isolation a little bit separated them.
Absolutely. Although that standing was extremely hard won during the Revolution, they were widely reviled. The fact again that they were led by a woman and were seen as breaking up families was a source of great tension. The fact that the leaders all had strong British accents and had recently come from England didn't endear them to many people when the country was pretty much divided by its own struggle with Great Britain. So they were widely accused of being spies. Anne Lee and her brother and some other lead Shakers were arrested for espionage, though the charges were false. So they spent a long time as a extremely embattled minority, and they were always having their cattle stolen and their buildings burned, and they were frequently attacked by mobs. That's probably why Anne Lee ended up dying. Was from injuries sustained during a series of riots. But over time, they won a certain begrudging respect from sort of the New England Protestant establishment and went from being seen as these sort of outcasts to a sort of just a part New England landscape, and the quality of their products certainly played a role in winning people over. It was sort of a proverbial in the time that it was something people would say about, you know, a basket of Shaker apples had the same quality apples on the bottom as the top. In other words, they were incredibly honest in their wares, and at a time when you couldn't really trust the things you were buying in a country store because there weren't brands, when something was stamped Shaker, it was considered a mark of honesty.
And one of the really interesting, I think, aspects of several of these different utopian communities, and this was true in this one, is the at least the move towards the interest in the ideal of equality between men and women, and really that meant a big deal about elevating women's status.
Yeah, absolutely. To citizens of their time, it's no longer the thing that shocks us the most about the Shakers. The thing that shocks most people the most is that they didn't have sex. But in their day, the thing that would have shocked people the most was that they had a female leadership. And it's one thing to have a female prophet and religious figure, as Ann Lee was, but even after Ann Lee died, the church maintained through its whole history, a sort of twin male and female sphere of leadership. And so that was extremely notable, and the Shakers believed in it. I mean, of course, they were people of their time, and there were exceptions. There were Shakers who wrote terrible things about women, but for the most part, they managed to enact a kind of gender equality that's quite remarkable from an era in which, you know, women didn't have authority anywhere outside of the home or maybe the classroom. The Shaker sisters, as they were known, or eldresses for the senior ones, were administering a massive empire of businesses and homes and infrastructure, and I mean, it was real hugely valuable network of farms, and it was largely run by women.
Just to finish up on the Shakers, Chris, is there anything you'd like to say, and we may come back to them, but anything else about them that you'd like to point out?
Well, I think what's interesting about them and what's relevant, I mean, there's a lot of different ways of thinking about the Shakers as a religious group, as social or economic innovators. The reason I'm most interested in them is sort of their utopianism, since that's the subject that I'm exploring in lots of different communities, and their underlying conviction which is what they share with the other people I write about, that a perfect human society can be built, and their extremely diligent efforts to achieve that. Obviously, they didn't succeed. We're not all Shakers, but they truly believed that a perfect society was possible. And whether you consider that naive or not, they made some incredible innovations along the way. And I think what they show us partly is that through a series of interesting reasons, they came to have a sort of relatively loose grip on the way the society in which they lived was organized and arranged. They didn't have much regard for the present social order, and that allowed them to see things that it probably took the rest of American society another 100 years to see, things like, you know, that healthcare maybe should be something we're all provided, or that men and women might be equal. These things that we now consider commonplace were seen so early by the Shakers, I think partly because they really didn't have a great deal of esteem for the way the world in which they lived was arranged.
So it seems to me that this whole utopian movement is a sensibility towards something more ideal. And while these utopian communities, maybe they're distinguished from that because they really had a fairly clear idea of some particular emphases for that. But it seems to me that part of the relevance of this now and looking at some of these communities is that whole kind of idealization of things and seeing a particular future that's possible. And it certainly seems to me that that's present now. With a lot of different kinds of groups of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there were particular conditions to the middle of the 19th century that pertained to the founding of the United States, and that pertained to the sort of conclusions of the Enlightenment, which was the sort of general notion of human progress as being the principle of history, the idea that was so commonplace then, which is not at all commonplace here in 2017 AD in the United States, that each year, or at the very least each decade, will be better than the last, and that as human knowledge expands, as we master science and what they didn't call social science, but was essentially a sort of social science, that the world will be in a continuous state of improvement. It wasn't. It's an idea which sounds so odd now, since we're I think many people agree in a rather low moment in our history, but it was a widespread idea then, and the utopians were perhaps the people who took that idea most seriously, that it was within the capacity of humankind to greatly, greatly improve our circumstances, and that would involve rearranging social structures, but also building new, you know, technologies and new types of buildings and towns. That idea was so widespread in the 19th century for a number of reasons, and obviously that idea is in short supply right now. But what we share with them is also a simultaneous sense of dissatisfaction. I think the idea that the present social order is not working as it should, and that was partly what spurred them.
So let's jump to another one in the book. Is it Oneida Perfectionists? Is that how to pronounce that?
Yeah. They went by a number of names. You know, they're usually referred to as the Oneida community because they were they lived in a place called Oneida, New York. But they called themselves alternately Bible communists or perfectionists, and others tended to call them perfectionists. And they were, again, there's a strong charismatic visionary, a man named John Humphrey Noyes, who was a Vermonter born in 1811, extremely intelligent man, well-educated, seminarian at Yale, who, like Ann Lee, has a series of specific religious revelations that set him on a path of trying to devise what he thought of as the perfect community, again, like the Shakers, that would somehow be a sort of portal through which the kingdom of heaven, which so many Americans at the time were eagerly anticipating, the kingdom of heaven would sort of be brought to earth through the community, was the idea at Oneida. They had a great deal in common with the Shakers, and then also a lot that was quite different.
Well, let's talk about some of the similarities. Certainly one of those similarities, and it differs from some of the others that you talk about, was this religious aspect to it.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that's interesting about the sort of arc of I proceed through telling the story of these communities chronologically, and what's interesting is the Shakers are very emphatically a religious organization, and they describe themselves as a faith. They were successful social innovators, but religion was front and center. But their social innovations went on to inspire a whole host of secular reformers who said, "Oh, look, if the Shakers can invent these societies without private property and total equality, we can do the same minus the religion." And those ideas germinate for almost a century, and at Oneida what happens is you get a religious person who's been studying the secular innovators, the people whom the Shakers inspired, and John Humphrey Noyes is interested in all of these non-religious sort of socialistic communities, and he once again reinserts religion. But the Shakers were still thriving at the time that the Oneida community was founded, and they were in very close rapport. One Shaker elder described the perfectionists as noble contestants in bringing the kingdom of heaven to earth. So they sort of saw each other as engaged in the same project through different routes.
One of the big differences, and they even use some of the same biblical text, is whereas the Shakers were celibate, the perfectionist advocated what we might these days call free love.
Yeah, absolutely. They John Humphrey Noyes and the other leaders of the Oneida community eventually disavow the term free love, but they also claim to have coined it, and they stopped using it because they thought it was being associated with unsavory people who were having sex for non-religious reasons. But the way their free love operated was essentially every adult male in the community was conceived of as married to every other to every adult female in the community. So they were allowed to have sex with whomever. In actual fact, it was rather closely regulated, and not everyone did have the same level of sexual liberty. But the basic idea was that what they called it was complex marriage, and what that name refers to is they saw it as all of them being married to each other. So they didn't think of it as free love. They thought of it as matrimonial sex. They just happened to be married to 300 people.
One of the interesting things that I found about them is there was at least this kind of sentiment, and even in practice, the idea that their understanding of this perfected community that they were trying to establish could evolve. And that seemed to me to be something that distinguished this group from all of the others. Would you say that's a fair characterization?
Yeah, that's very astute, and that's absolutely right. And that is, I was mentioning how John Humphrey Noyes was a student of the previous secular experiments, and that's a direct consequence of that. He writes over and over again how he's seen these overly rigid sort of utopian programs falter, and the lesson he learned from that, and one of the things that made the Oneida community so successful for so long was that you had to adapt. He, of course, framed it often in religious terms, that the sort of spirit of God would speak through the community and guide it in new directions. But basically, he had learned that you know, human nature is a complicated and shifting thing, and one of the things that has felled utopian communities consistently throughout history, and you could say the same of you know, the Soviet program or overly rigid social structures, is that they stifle the natural human tendency to shift and be creative and evolve. So the Oneida community was very good at he always used a sailing metaphor, you know, trimming sails or tacking in a new direction. That was one of their specialties.
And another thing they shared with the Shakers is this elevation or this equality of the sexes. So would you talk about that in their conception?
Yeah, it was, again, it's a very important caveat to say that these were people of their time, and perhaps more importantly, they were people of any time. They were humans, and so stated ideals often were at odds with the way things really were in the community, and you know, certain students of the Oneida community hate when people say that they had gender equality, because practically speaking, there were many ways in which they didn't. But compared to their compatriots at the time, women within the Oneida community had a great deal of autonomy, and at least autonomy within the bounds of a somewhat bureaucratic community. But they did the same work as men. They had the same sexual liberty, I think, was a very important way in which their autonomy was expressed. You know, the people are often disturbed by the fact that sort of older men within the Oneida community were, you know, had sex with younger women, and of course that is disturbing. But the it's notable that the same thing happened in reverse. Young men were sexually initiated into the community by the female elders of the community. And another way that the sort of female liberation, if that word makes sense, can be expressed to the Oneida community is they invented, long before the bloomers took off, they invented their own sort of costume. To the Victorian garb of the time made it almost impossible for women to engage in any kind of physical activity, and they did away with that and wore these sort of combination of these sort of short skirted blouse things over leggings that gave the women, which people outside of the Oneida community at the time found distasteful, and in fact women from the community were sort of stoned and heckled wherever they went for wearing these things. But they were a deliberate attempt to erase to some extent the distinction that the society placed between men and women.
You mentioned the sexual establishment and older men having sex with younger women and vice versa. Could you talk a little bit about the, I don't know if it's fair to say, theoretical underpinnings of that, or at least the vision of what backed that up? It wasn't just an arbitrary kind of thing.
No, there was a, as there often is in religious communities where sex plays a role, there was an extremely elaborate theological argument. I'll just say you mentioned yourself that the Shakers and the Perfectionists both were referring to the same biblical verses to justify their sort of opposite systems. One group advocating no sex, the other group advocating lots of sex. And basically, there's a section in the Bible that talks about, you know, in the kingdom of God, Jesus says in response to someone who's asked him a question, there will be there won't be husbands and wives, and the idea is that there'll be no marriage. And the Shakers interpret that, since they both thought they were living in the kingdom of God, the Shakers said, well, if there's no marriage, that means there's no sex. And the Perfectionists read the same words to say, like, oh, if there's no marriage, then we can all have sex. So it's a great example of how what you bring to a biblical text will inform where you land. But the basic idea was they believed that there was a sort of hierarchy of spirituality within the community, who was more sort of in touch with the actual Spirit of God in the program of developing the kingdom of heaven on earth. And sex was one of the ways through which this spiritual wisdom could be conveyed. So a younger man might have sex with an older sort of woman who had been designated as highly spiritual as a way of advancing his own spirituality. It's worth noting that the way they had sex was unorthodox also. They practiced noise. The leader of the community developed. He believed that the community shouldn't have children until they could more thoroughly establish the kingdom of heaven. And he thought that the only reasonable way, since his Christianity forbade other methods of birth control, of doing that was for what he called male continence, which, in other words, the man never climaxes, if you'll forgive me being graphic on public radio. And so the sex at Oneida put an enormous emphasis on female sexual pleasure, something that was sort of unheard of at the time, and they spoke at great length about the ideal way to make women sexually satisfied, but the men themselves were never supposed to conclude, was the word they often used, or have the propagative crisis, was the euphemism of the time. and their birth records bear out that they were pretty successful. There were obviously some slip-ups, but they had very few children until late in their history. They embarked on a sort of eugenics program whereby they were going to breed sort of a new race of perfected spiritual individuals by picking certain members of the community and coupling them, and they would produce children, and then those children would be taken from their parents and raised collectively in this sort of hyper-communized state where they all shared the same beds and they all have the same toys. And these individuals, who they called stirpa cults, were raised up, and they were supposed to lead the community in its next chapter into the 20th century. But the community broke up when the stirpa cults were sort of in their teens, and actually a great deal of them went on to lead very successful and notable lives. They had received a great deal of very well thought out and intentional pedagogy. They all, you know, had music lessons and classical literature lessons, and the Oneida community in general was a highly, unlike the Shakers, was a highly literate, highly intellectual community. Unlike sort of what we think of with a modern day cult, they were very keen on being in rapport with the wider world, sending their ideas out and bringing ideas from the wider world in.
Well, that's one more theme that I want to explore. Couple of things I want to do before I open the phone line. So one of the themes across a number of these communities is this idea that if they could establish this utopian community, that it would serve as a model for the rest of the world, and as such a shining exemplar of what was possible, it would end up really kind of propagating throughout. And that's pretty consistent across all five of them, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think that's why they can all be fairly called utopian. I draw a distinction, which is some might see as somewhat arbitrary, between sort of communes and collectivist communities in general and those communities that I describe as utopian. And the distinction I use for that definition is people who were their program, and therefore all of their rhetoric was about the total transformation of the globe. They were not interested, like so many of the, I mean, since we're having this conversation in Mendocino County, where there was a great deal of communalism in the 1970s up to the present, they were not concerned with withdrawing from the world to live their own perfected society. They were really deeply focused on the total transformation of the globe. And the way they thought that would happen, as you just mentioned, was that these model communities would be so compelling and they would be so successful that as soon as they were up and running, other people would imitate them, and before too long. I mean, they had these predictions that now seem laughably unrealistic. You know, within a couple of decades, the entire globe would be sort of blanketed in communities reflecting their individual program, whatever the various of the communities were, and their programs were all slightly different. But they all shared that utopian imperative to completely transform the world rather than just to create their own idealized sort of garden walled off from the wider world.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Chris Jennings. He's author of Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism. Chris, I've already got a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and take the call. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Yeah, this is Jesse.
Hi, Jesse. Go ahead.
Hi. Fascinating show, and I had a question for your guest. What about lesbianism? Was that ever practiced in these communities? What was the attitude towards it?
That's a great question, Jesse, and it's something that was a source of great frustration to me at the time was that, for obvious reasons, homosexuality of any sort, and I'm assuming you said lesbianism because of a slightly bad connection.
I mean, either one. I mean,
it doesn't appear in the historical record almost at all, for obvious reasons, you know, and all we have to go on is what these people wrote down, and that wasn't something that was widely documented. But I think, I believe, and I think other people who have studied this history believe that it's extremely likely that these communities, which, if you sort of stand back from them, offered a alternative. You know, in a time where there was really no other alternative to the nuclear farming family, that was the only unit of society.
Yeah.
These communities would probably have been very attractive to people who didn't, for one reason or another, want to live that life. And so I suspect that they sheltered a great deal of homosexuals, but that said, the Shakers, which towards the end of their history was overwhelmingly female, derided any sort of sexuality, whether it was, you know, homosexual. And the Oneida community, for all of their talk of free love, it was restricted to two-person heterosexual couplings. They don't even mention homosexuality, I suspect, because it seemed so beyond the pale to them. But I mean, their reaction to, you know, something like masturbation is extremely harsh. So I suspect that these communities sheltered a lot of homosexuals, but sadly it doesn't appear too much in the historical record.
Yeah, it's tricky. A lot of people had trouble researching this particular aspect. Also, at least where women are concerned, because there were relationships that, with modernized, we would assume that they were lesbian. But they may not have been. They may have just been very intimate female relationships. We're not sure.
Yeah, exactly. And there are you know, these incredibly tender letters from amongst Shaker sisters or women in these other communities. And it was not surprisingly, given how the world works, often a charge that was leveled against these communities was that they were up to all sorts of sexual deviance. deviancy. So outsiders certainly accused them of homosexuality. They usually used more indecorous language. But there's not much in the historical record, but I think it's pretty safe to assume that this was more homosexuals would have been present in these communities, I would guess, than in the, you know, than would be sort of represented statistically in the wider society.
Awesome. Well, thanks.
Thanks, Jesse.
Thank you. It was fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, I do want to let people know that if you'd like to call and ask Chris a question, again, the book is Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism, and the phone number is 707-895-2448 or dj@kzyx.org. One more thing that I wanted to, because I found it interesting in the perfectionist community, was this idea of a talking cure or mutual criticism. It seemed to me like it could potentially have some real benefits, but also some real pressure on people in that kind of a situation. Would you talk just briefly about that?
Sure, yeah. I think that was one of sort of the real secrets to the success of the Oneida community, and I think you're right that it was something that was alternately incredibly wholesome and could probably become quite disturbing, which is they would gather periodically for what they called mutual criticism. They didn't use the phrase talking cure, that's me, but the idea of mutual criticism was that the community, some person gets in the hot seat, and community members sort of unload on them. I mean, theoretically, they were you know, trying to make the person under criticism that evening or afternoon a better person. So people would sort of list their flaws, and it was you know, anyone, and I'm sure some of your listeners have lived in communal situations, knows that things can sort of fester, and I think this allowed the Oneida community to smooth over a lot of the frustrations of communal living, because it's undeniable that living with 300 people in one house causes natural frictions. But if you read some of the things people were criticized for, some of them are sort of brilliant criticisms that you imagine really were helpful, and other times it's very petty stuff. I laughed out loud skimming through a stack of these things when a man who had moved from Vermont was accused of talking too much about Vermont. And people agreed he spent much too much time talking about Vermont. So sometimes it was sort of petty stuff. But some of them were very interesting. Men were often accused of acting too macho, or women of acting too feminine. And the idea was that they were perfecting not just their community, but simultaneously perfecting themselves. And there was this sort of religious notion that God spoke not through the individual, but through the collective. And therefore, collective criticism was the right way to perfect individuals. And they did practice, probably to a lesser extent, collective praise. You know, they would all gather around and say, you know, Mary did a great job making sure all the cows were taken care of this week or whatever. So it was an essential part of how the community was run. One of the things that gave them the flexibility that you referred to earlier was that they didn't have a lot of written rules. And in lieu of written rules, this was sort of how they policed themselves. If someone was not pulling their weight, or, you know, was eating too much of the butter at dinner or whatever, this is where it would come out and be said.
I have to say, some of these ideas, I grew up in the 60s, and while I can't say that I lived in a commune, I did live in kind of communal situations, and in our hubris of the time, we thought that some of these ideas, we called them encounter groups, maybe would be a parallel to mutual criticism and the whole idea of free love in the 60s. You know, we thought that we'd come up with those ideas, but so it was very interesting to find that this started 100 years earlier, some of these ideas, and maybe some of them go back even further, but that there was a real movement for many of these ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's sort of how I got interested. I was studying, you know, communalism in the 60s and 70s, and found sort of scant references to these 19th century movements. And I should note that the Shakers and the Perfectionists, who we're mostly discussing, were hardly the most radical amongst the movements of the time. Some of the more secular movements had much more wild ideas. And it was startling to see that, you know, ideas in 1848. Would make people in 1868 blush, you know, how extreme some of their ideas of free love, or, you know, the one thing that's missing was any kind of experimentation with intoxicants. They lacked that, but they certainly speak about sort of religious ecstasies in language that often sounds, you know, straight out of the Haight-Ashbury.
Right. Well, we've got time, and in case somebody, unless somebody else calls in and has a question, again, the phone number is 895-2448. Let's just mention the names of the people who started the other three that you talk about in the book. And again, I just want to let people know that the book comes out in paperback next Tuesday. And if you would mention their names, and I think one of the interesting themes of some of the others is this idea that the non-spiritual ones, that it was an attempt to establish an environment, that it was the environment that really shaped the character. So maybe you could veer off into that direction a little bit.
Sure, sure. Well, just to say generally about the environment shaping the character, that was a real hallmark of that era, even, you know, not just within these communities. It was a sort of progressive era and post-Enlightenment idea that individuals are really the product of the institutions in which they live, which is an idea that hasn't totally gone away, but I think has less credence now than it, or less currency now than it did at the time. And so therefore, if you want to create the perfect society, you create these structures which will educate people and shape people and sort of condition them to be a certain type of individual. And when you've done enough of that, you'll be living in a whole new world. But to quickly get to the other people who held that idea, after the Shakers, I write about a community in New Harmony, the community called New Harmony, which is in Indiana, run by an incredibly wealthy British industrialist turned communist and atheist named Robert Owen. That was huge, but had a very brief reign, and it was largely inspired by the Shakers and some other Christian sects. But Owen, who had a fair amount of hubris, thought, well, if these crazy religious people can remake society, think about how easy it'll be if we just get rid of the religious ideas. That didn't work out so well, but some of the values they put into action there would warm the heart of any 21st century progressive, and it's quite impressive the time and place they did that. After the collapse of New Harmony, I move on to what is undoubtedly the strangest and probably the most prolific utopian movement in American history, which was called alternately Fourierism or Associationism, which was based on the ideas of a very eccentric Frenchman who himself never made it to the United States, but his ideas did, named Charles Fourier, and almost 30 communities based on his ideas were established across the country, the most famous being the Brook Farm community, which was just outside of Boston, where a lot of the famous transcendentalists were either members or sort of associates coming and going throughout the week, like Emerson and Hawthorne and Thoreau. And Fourier also had ideas about free love and about the right way of organizing industry and society, and incredibly detailed plans for how to create the perfect society. And then after the Fourier boom ends, I write about a group of French, they called themselves communists, followers of a guy named Étienne Cabet, who preached the sort of mystical Christian communism that really wasn't that spiritually based, was more economic. And he had written this very strange novel called Travels in Icaria, describing a fictional fantasy land. It's almost like a sci-fi novel, but it starts with a boat voyage, not a spaceship. And it became so popular in France that its readers formed themselves into little groups and began calling themselves Icarians after the fictional nation at the heart of this novel. And they came in fair numbers to the United States, first to Texas, then to Illinois, and ultimately to Iowa, and to not far from you, their final settlement was in Mendocino County, they had a long and difficult run, and then I go from them into the Oneida community.
Okay, we had somebody that was calling in, and I think it timed out. So if you've got a question, please give us a call at 895-2448. We're getting down to the end of the show. I think a couple of points to make. One of them is that none of these utopian communities lasted, and most of them, I think maybe even all of them, didn't outlast their particular leader. I guess some of them went beyond it a little bit with following presidents and such, but none of them really lasted. Even, and the Shakers, I guess you say at the end, even that group, which has been around quite a long time, is now down to just a few people.
Yeah, there are I believe two now in northern Maine who are Shakers, and I have great esteem for them. I think what they're keeping alive is wonderful. But you're right. Practically speaking, Shakerism fizzled out in the middle of the 20th century. And I think that these communities have largely been judged just for their collapse, and I think that that's a sort of rather short-sighted way of thinking about them. Just the fact that they didn't last forever doesn't, to my mind, make them failures, especially when some of the things that they preached are now commonplace. So I tried in writing about them not to be fixated by their undoing, though of course their undoing is always interesting. People tend to think that they just died because they were impractical, and to some extent that's true. But they all collapsed for their own specific reasons, died of their own causes, and sometimes, you know, the people who left the communities very often went forth into their life remembering their time in these communities as sort of the high point of their lives, and in that particular sense, I think that they can be largely judged as success.
One other theme, you've mentioned it already, but I wanted to just highlight it. They all, and maybe this is a characteristic of this kind of idealism, this kind of utopianism, they all had visions of really being able to transform things certainly much more rapidly than possible. So I would have to say that none of them really had a very good sense, and you talk about it more deeply in the book about many of them starting off their communities without a very good realistic sense of what it was going to take. And so maybe that's the dynamic between kind of an idealism and a realism.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that you see in the book and in studying, and that I saw in studying their histories, was the incredible potency of idealism in motivating people to do things, because although I just said that these communities all die by their own causes, for their own reasons, one of the things that they have in common is that they all really begin to unravel at the moment when the utopian vision starts to fade. So people would put up with incredible hardship, you know, scant food, long hours, uncomfortable sleeping conditions, annoying bedmates, whatever. They would put up with everything when they thought that the dream was on the horizon, and they could do that for years. But if something happened that made it seem like the dream wasn't going to ever be fulfilled, things would very rapidly unravel. And I think that shows the sort of power of idealism to point people all in one direction and to put up with a lot of hardship and make the sort of personal sacrifices which, you know, frankly, are the key to any kind of social progress. There's work to it. And these people undertook a great deal of work for, to my mind, rather noble reasons.
I think we're going to have to leave it there. We're down at the end of the hour. Once again, my guest has been Chris Jennings, author of Paradise Now, The Story of American Utopianism. He talks about five different utopian communities. We focused in on just a couple. There are three more. He goes into a lot of depth and detail and develops the themes of this utopian movement in the 19th century. The book's going to be available in paperback starting on Tuesday. Chris, I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was really fun.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye, thanks.